chapter 2, which we just finished, was about the general categories which are set up for man's existence, and the person, by his actions, will place himself in one category or another. Theoretically, everybody could act the same way, and everybody could end up in the same category. Chapter 3 is about the differences that are imposed on people, where people set out under different conditions, and those different conditions affect the choices that are available to them, and the consequences of their choices, where people are necessarily divided by their very creation. And the first, most important idea here is this. Way back in part one, he said, God is perfection. We are supposed to resemble God as much as a creature can resemble God. But a creature can't be perfect the way God is perfect. So, creature perfections were created and made available to the creature to be its share in perfection. These are, in some sense, analogs of God's perfection, but analogs on the level of a creature. Let's remember the example that we've already used. Being self-determined. Being self-determined, not being dependent on something outside of yourself. Self-contained. Self-sufficient. Now, God is absolutely self-determined, absolutely self-sufficient, not dependent upon anything outside of himself, because he is perfection. And that's one of the things that perfection is. Man is in part self-determined because he has free will. So there's a big difference between man's being self-determined and God's being self-determined. God is absolutely, completely self-determined by virtue of his very nature. Man is partially self-determined by virtue of exercising free will. If you look at the guts of it, they're really very different. Man has it because of his essential nature. God has it because of his essential nature. And man has it because he makes free choices. Still, at the end of the day, there is something about man that is there because of himself. And that is similar to the fact that God is what he is because of himself. So, at the end of the day, there's a sort of similarity, even though what causes the characteristics in the two cases is different, and the degree is different, there's a sort of similarity. That's the kind of model for the idea that what we call human virtues are really offshoots of God's perfection, offshoots and analogs to God's perfection, analogs that are relevant to a creature. Insofar as given the fact that the creature can't have God's perfection as God has it, because he isn't God, he's a creature. And he doesn't explain in detail how they're related, but that's the general idea, that's the abstract idea. And, as he points out, there are many such perfections. All of what we think of as virtues, all of what we think of as morally desirable traits are reflections on the level of a creature of God's perfection. So, now I'm skipping a step, which I have to confirm. I'll fill in when I come back to the end. So if you feel I'm skipping a step here, you're right. Now, There are so many of these different perfections that it's very difficult to imagine a person, a single person, accomplishing all of them. Worse than that, if you look at carefully at the perfections, you'll see that each perfection can be developed only in a certain environment, in a certain background of conditions. And that the background conditions for different perfections are different. If you're under one background condition, you can't be under the other background condition. They contradict one another. And then if you analyze it more carefully, you'll see that you could vary the conditions slightly, and each variation of the conditions will vary the particular perfection that's relevant to those conditions. So let's take some examples. These are the examples that he gives. What perfection would be relevant to wealth? The person is wealthy. So he says, a wealthy person is tested to see whether he'll be generous and share the wealth that he has with the poor. He's also tested to see whether he'll become proud and whether the fact that he has wealth will attract him to invest in worldly goods and worldly experiences. How many people have heard of Neiman Marcus? Neiman Marcus is a company designed to destroy your soul. What they do is, they create gifts so that the person who has everything doesn't have this. And of course, it's got to cost, you know, $200 million. So that when you buy this, you're the only person on the planet who has it, and then you're one up on everybody else. And, you know, miniature elephants that play the violin. Who else has that? If you have that, you're it. You're number one, the top. Right? So every holiday season, people go thumbing through the Neiman Marcus catalog, and they look for the latest Trivial Pursuit, you know, which is only available to the very rich. So that's the second challenge. Third challenge, you got generosity, pride, being submerged in the pursuit of worldly goods. This challenge only applies to the rich. A poor person doesn't have the challenge of learning to ignore the Neiman Marcus catalog because he can't even afford the catalog, let alone afford the things in the catalog.
What's the line between party and pride?
Yeah, let me check the Hebrew. You're right. I mean, at this point, I wasn't analyzing it today in that detail, but you're right. If he uses two words, so then, 1 second.
Haughty and pride.
And haughty, like being egotistical.
Well, you know what? There's only one word in Hebrew. Surprise, surprise. If there were two words in Hebrew, then I'd have to work hard to see what the difference is. But there's only one word in Hebrew. It means, in the Hebrew it says, Yerum bo libo, his heart will grow high. So I guess, I don't know what Robert Kaplan had in mind, but he's not reflecting a careful distinction in Hebrew. There's only one word.
The words in English are quite different, though.
Haughty and proud?
What's that? Like, I paint my room nice blue color. I paint my room and I did a nice job. I didn't splatter the paint anywhere.
Yeah.
I say, look at this. I'm proud of it. But I don't even haughty about it. Haughty is sort of, you know, haughty is sort of...
It's a bad caricature.
I'm haughty. I drive a Mercedes and, you know.
Maybe proud is an inner quality and haughty is a social quality.
Okay.
In other words, if you behave, if you look down at other people and express it in behavior, then you could say he's a haughty person.
Right.
Pride could be more inner. That's what he feels about himself, but he might not show it to anybody else. Maybe that's the difference. But that's a challenge in English that had nothing to do with the Hebrew. It's quite interesting. I'm surprised that he would use two words in English. There's only one word in Hebrew. Okay. So Those are the challenges of the rich person. The poor person has the challenge of being honest, not stealing, and the challenge of thanking God for what he has, rather than being disgruntled, disappointed, disaffected, you know, just in general. Now, let's see. Can we imagine one person developing generosity and resisting Neiman Marcus and working on resisting pride together with poverty? That's not his challenge if he's poor. A poor person is not tempted to be proud. Proud of what? Proud of what he ain't got? A poor person is not tempted to invest in Neiman Marcus. It's beyond his capacity. So that temptation is not facing him, and that perfection, the perfection of rising above the lure of endless chasing after material goods, that perfection is not available to a poor person. On the other hand, the perfection of thanking God for the little that you have and not being disappointed and angry that you don't have more, that doesn't apply to a rich, well, to a psychologically sane rich person. I mean, some people say, I've only got 20 billion, you know, I've got to Bill Gates yet. Why are you holding back on me? You know, where's my other 40 billion? But I can imagine rich people who don't feel like that. And now, so his point is that each condition in life gives the opportunity to develop a different kind of creature perfection, a different kind of human perfection. People who live with sickness, who can't do everything that other people can do, have a certain kind of challenge to be thankful for what they can do, rather than plunge into despair of what they can't do. Yeah, I will just insert a footnote here. I don't know how many of you have ever seen, when you buy postcards, you find sometimes postcards with beautiful paintings on the front, and on the back it says, painted by so-and-so who's a quadriplegic, which means that he has lost the use of his arms and legs, paralyzed both arms and legs, who learned to paint with his toes, and he painted this picture. Now, you could imagine a catastrophe of becoming a quadriplegic. Paralyzed from the waist down. From the neck down. There are two ways to react to that. One way is to say, I'll never go skiing, and I'll never go running, I'll never walk, I'll never be able to share activities like tennis or mountain climbing or, you know, even chess. I have to tell them where to move the pieces. You know, I can't pick up the cheap pieces myself. Life is over. You know, this is what I get to live for. And such a person can go into despair and die. Die because he just gives up on life. Another person who says, okay, no skiing, no tennis, no strolls in the park. What can I do? I read about a fellow who became a weather forecaster. He learned to type at the computer with his toes. And he examines the weather, the satellite photographs of the weather patterns. And you give a weather forecast. What's the difference? The difference is between looking at what you don't have and looking at what you do have. The healthy person, it's the old adage of the half full cup and the half empty cup. It's the same cup. It all depends on how you look at it. Here, with such a gigantic loss, the person says, what do I have left and what can I do? By the way, it's probably worthwhile to develop that attitude sooner or later, because as it gets later, you're definitely going to lose things. As you get older and older, at a certain point, you start losing some of the capacity that you once had. If losing capacity is going to devastate you, it will definitely be harder to live a long lifetime. If you have the attitude of looking to what you have left and seeing what you can do with it, then you can have a creative and satisfying lifetime. As long as it goes. At any rate, that's a challenge for the sick person, not for the healthy person. That's a challenge for the person who has had an accident and suffered an injury, not for the person who's fully functional. So each condition of life has its own challenge, has its own creature perfection, which can be developed. And since giving the goods means that the creatures should embody as much God-likeness as possible. Each of these creature perfections is a contribution to the good that God is giving to the creatures that he created. Now, I've talked so far about poverty and wealth, sickness and health, but you can introduce variations. There's a big difference between a person who became rich through working himself up from nothing versus a person who inherited his wealth. They feel differently about their wealth. And the wealth is a different kind of challenge. For example, the challenge of pride. The challenge of pride is much harder. For which one? Really? I think it's much harder for the person who earned it. The person who earned it is tempted to say, I made the money. I created it for myself. I did it. That's why the nouveau riche are so disgusting. They've forgotten that French phrase? Nouveau riche means the newly rich. You know, a person who has had money in the family for 5 years can afford, five generations, can afford to play things down. You know, he can go in a polo shirt and slacks. He doesn't have to drive the latest Porsche, you know, because everybody knows his family has it. But the nouveau riche has to show it off. If he doesn't show it off, how will anybody know he has it? So, and that's why they are so irritating. You know, they can't deal with their money with class, because it's under such pressure to show off their success. So the challenges of egotism, the challenge of pride, is much greater for a person who made the money on his own than it is for a person who inherited the money.
Don't you mean more humility than pride for that nouveau riche thing? Like, you know, to be humble about sort of what they have.
I don't think,
I mean, if you're driving around in a fancy car, that's more sort of showing off, and, you know, yeah, rather than like worrying about the pride. I mean, a person who has it in the family, you know,
they
may have this inherent, like, humbleness, you know, because...
So how is what you're saying related to what I said? The nouveau riche, the guy who made it for himself, is what?
Well, I guess arrogant about it.
Right. He wants to show it off, right?
Yeah.
Now, people typically want to show off things they're proud of. You don't show off things that you're embarrassed about. You don't show off things you're disappointed about. You show off things you're proud of. His desire to show it off shows that he's proud of it.
Yeah, but aren't you more referring to humility than pride?
In what context? I mean, the challenge for him is to become humble.
Yeah, because
pride is so natural. Yes. Yeah. And it's less of a challenge for a person who's had money for five generations, because he can take it for granted. Furthermore, since he didn't earn it, it's a little harder for him to be proud of it. Proud of my great-great-grandfather, maybe, but, you know, that's not the same as being proud of your own accomplishment.
So, for that person who's inherited it, it's not really humility he should deal with, maybe it's more tzedakah.
Yeah, as I'm saying, the challenge there is not as great. So that's not his main basic challenge. I'm saying not as great a challenge, right? But what am I showing you here? I'm showing you that even within the rich, you vary the circumstances, and you can get a variation on the challenge. What about a person who was very rich, lost it all, and then got it all back?
It's even bigger.
He's going to feel very differently from a person who had it all the time, because he's lived on the other side. In between, he knows how fragile it is. So it's going to have a different kind. For him, charity might be more difficult, because he could say, listen, I lost it once. Who knows what's around the corner? I better just keep it for myself. And so each variation is going to cause a variation in the challenge, and a variation in the particular type of perfection that the person could achieve. Yeah.
Would you say that it could be a similar situation, that when you've earned it or made it yourself, you can be more proudful to newly religious people?
Yes.
Challenge for them is.
Well, it would be so. This is a tricky thing. This is an interesting observation. You hear what he's asking. What about a person who becomes religious? He could say, you were born into it. You inherited it. You got it for nothing. You were trained it by your parents. But I made it for myself. You know, I'm terrific. You know, you're just doing it out of roads. In theory, you're right. But there's an obstacle. If the newly religious person makes it up in his performance to the standard of those who were born into it, then I think that would be a danger. But that's rare. It's rare for that to happen.
But if you
usually the religious person remains at a lower standard of performance. And since he remains at a lower standard of performance, it's hard for him to take pride in it. If he really made it up there, you know, then that could be a challenge. I agree. Because there's this counterbalancing thing that he knows he's still second.
Can pride be a non-competitive thing? Can you be proud of the fact, let's say you're Chassid Shalom, an alcoholic, and you decide that you went to Alcoholics Anonymous and you've become a non-alcoholic. Do you have a right to be proud of yourself, or did you just happen to be one of those that Hashem decided to save? How do you know whether you should be proud of yourself or it's all given to you?
Okay, that's a crucial comment, although I think your second sentence does not really connect with your first sentence. I mean, they're two different ideas.
Didn't we say that pride wasn't a problem? Pride is in yourself. Well, there's no problem with being proud. It's when you become haughty, and then you start saying, you know, I did it. So pride is not really a problem.
Well, I think it is a problem.
I was asking whether you have a right to decide. Did you achieve whatever you achieved, or did was it given to you?
This is the great antidote to pride. This is the great antidote to pride. The sources talk about this. Moses. Moses was the greatest prophet who ever lived and ever will live. Moses took the Jewish people out of Egypt, was God's representative to do that. He went to heaven to get the Torah down to earth. And the Torah says Moses was the humblest of all men. Now how did he manage that? Could Moses be honest with himself? Or does Moses have to say, who, me? I'm just a regular Joe like everybody else. You know, you have your life, I have my life. Everybody does his own thing. Why are you looking at me? I'm not special. Which is, of course, not true. Can Moses be honest to himself about his greatness, his great accomplishments, and yet be humble? And yet the Torah says he's the humblest of all men on the face of the earth.
Only if he recognized or believed that his, whatever it was that made him so special, came from outside himself.
Okay, so I think that's the key. After all, Moses' father was the leader of the previous generation. His older brother and sister were prophets. He was given a very special soul. He was given a king's education in the palace. Not everybody gets a start like that. So Moses later says, look at all the things that I accomplished, but look where I came from. Shall I compare my accomplishments to the tailor down the street? He didn't grow up in a palace and get a king's education. He wasn't born into the greatest family in the Jewish nation in the previous generation. So of course, why shouldn't I be expected to do more? How much of my greater performance is due to my greater effort versus what's due to God's greater investment in me? And it's very difficult to know that. I would say it's impossible to know. And that's a great antidote to pride. Maybe the fellow down the street who turns out a mediocre, average performance deserves more credit than I do with my very superior performance. Because it could be just what's invested in. John Stuart Mill, whom I quote from time to time, was one of the great English intellectuals of the 19th and 20th century. His parents were both outstanding intellectuals. They were quite wealthy. They hired private tutors for him, and they tutored him at home. Is it any shock that a kid with talent under those conditions will turn out to be an outstanding intellectual? That's not a surprising result. Can he claim a lot of credit for that? I don't think so. Pick somebody up from the ghetto and give him the same kind of resources, maybe he'll turn out to be just as good. He just didn't have the chance. He didn't have the opportunity.
Well, there's got to be a balance, because maybe his brothers may not have turned out as great as he.
Okay, and then that depends upon what his genetics are, right? He may have had a genetic predisposition to it. So, but you don't know. And since you don't know, it's very hard to take credit for it. Now, pride is largely fueled by the desire to take credit. I'll give you an example. I don't know how you got to be as thin as you are. But there are two possibilities. I know people who are genetically thin. They can eat anything in any amounts, and they stay thin. Boy, do I envy them. Then other people who have to seriously diet in order to stay thin.
Well, I'm one of the latter ones, but by the same token...
Oh, but now listen.
Did I get help from...
But one second. I'm looking at the temptation now. Now, who's more likely to take pride in being fit? Someone who diets or someone who has a genetic?
Diets.
Someone who diets. I did it. I made myself fit. You just eat whatever you like. You don't have to control yourself at all. And you fit automatically. It's hard to take pride in that. It's sort of taking pride in your blue eyes. Like your Well, you could, sort of, but it's certainly not the same as your physique if you work out and you make yourself your own physique. So a great source of pride is the desire to take credit for my own efforts. Right? So now, as you said, when I recognize that I don't know how much of my success is due to my efforts and how much of my success is due to the investments that God made in me, that's a great antidote to pride. Yes?
Well, I'm going to go along that same line about the issue of using the gifts you have. I mean, if a man is tutored by leading teachers, trained, nurtured in a discipline, and his gifts, you know, he doesn't use them, he's a bum.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's a...
Quite right.
How do we discuss that?
Yeah, no, you need both. You need both factors working together. He's got to make the effort, and the right conditions have to be there. The problem is, when you see the result... How you decompose the result into the two factors and judge each factor separately is very difficult to do that. And that's the antidote to pride, because he says, I don't know how much is due to which one. Yeah.
You said pride is largely prompted by taking credit.
Yeah.
And what's the other side to it?
Well, I used to say it was totally that way, but then people convinced me that some people are proud of how tall they are, or they're proud of their beautiful blue eyes, you know, things which really are gifts. And some people are proud of the money that they inherited. I'm a little uneasy with the idea, but I have to admit that you do come across people like that.
Are they proud? Half of me feel good about it.
Well, okay. It seems there's a certain pride. Now, I want to go back to your first comment, because the two comments really had nothing to do with one another, as far as I can tell. Your first question was, is pride inherently competitive? Is pride a matter of measuring myself relative to other people? I think it is. And the test of it would be this. Is it possible for a person to be proud of having something that everybody else also has?
Yes.
I doubt it. I have two eyes. Wow. Think of that. Boy, am I proud of the fact that I have two eyes. I don't think that works.
He could be proud of, but he could be proud of the way he keeps his.
But that's something he does and not everybody does. And so forth and so on. You know, I'm proud of the fact that I'm breathing all the time. You know, not an hour goes by where I don't breathe. How about that? You know,
how about the fact that everyone else in the class...
I'm proud of the fact that I was born.
How about the fact that everyone else in the class was able to do 15 push-ups last year, and you went and you worked, and finally, you're just like the rest of them. Now you can do 13 push-ups.
Yeah, but they didn't all start with six and worked the way up. I'm talking about having what everybody else has. I have an achievement that they don't have. I'm talking about really being the same as everybody else. I don't think you could be proud of having of being or doing or having something that everybody else has.
Unless you don't know.
Now, if that's the case, then pride really is inherently comparative. Pride rests on the perception that I'm better than other people in some way, and then taking credit for it and looking down on other people because of it, and that's I think the complex that's involved in pride.
Could pride be where you're a competition with yourself, like where you were?
Not if everybody else is making the same progress.
No. Not if everybody.
I grew an inch last year, but so did everybody in my class grow an inch last year. It'd be hard to be proud of that.
And not if everybody else has to hear about it.
That's the thing. If I was right before when I said that pride is inner and haughtiness is outer, it could be possible to have pride and just keep it to yourself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I don't know if that has to be expressed. It's just more disgusting when it's expressed. Okay, we're really drifting around here, I think. Okay. Okay, so now, time for the first very important conclusion. And then I told you there's something wrong here. I skipped a step, and I'll go back and fill in the step. So, there are different qualities of perfections, the creature perfections that have to be mastered. And those require different qualities of life. And nobody was up in arms when I said one of them is poverty. And nobody was up in arms when I said one of them is sickness. It means that a person can be poor and or sick, not because of anything he's done wrong. Not as a punishment. But only because that's his assignment to achieve that particular perfection. Already this introduces a very new way to look at the conditions people are under. The person is suffering. That suffering may have nothing to do with a failure on his part and may have nothing to do with being punished. If you remember one thing from all these lectures, if you remember one thing, put it in your pocket and be useful to you, remember this. Not all suffering is punishment. Not all suffering is punishment. If you forget that, you're in the pocket of the academic trickster who will defeat you with one question. Aren't there innocent people suffering? Why is God punishing them? God can't be a just, a good God if he's punishing all his innocent people, including children. Why do I call him a trickster? Because he's making this false assumption. He's assuming that suffering is punishment. The minute you recognize that not all suffering is punishment, that suffering has a multitude of purposes and not all of them are punishment, the question drops away as irrelevant. So you have that in your pocket. You can sit and listen to him calmly and then, you know, say, listen, let me inform you of something that every six-year-old should know. Not all suffering is punishment. So don't assume that the person is being punished. Now you hear the person, let's say, who's poor his whole life. Don't, in the privacy of your own mind, say, boy, he must really be rotten. Look at that. God isn't giving him any money. And he's suffering this poverty his whole life. Something must be wrong with him. No. It could be that that's his assignment. His assignment is to achieve human perfection in the condition of poverty. Just like somebody else's assignment is to achieve human perfection in the condition of wealth. Indeed, spiritually, wealth is much worse. Wealth is much worse than poverty. A person whose goals are spiritual would be much happier to be poor than to be wealthy. Because the challenges that we mentioned are much more difficult. They're much subtler. They're much easier to undermine the person's spiritual focus than the challenges of poverty. King Solomon put it this way. He said, lest I become poor and steal, lest I become rich and deny God. The temptation of the poor person is to steal. The temptation of the rich person is to deny God, to take credit for his own success. It's a much bigger temptation with much bigger consequences. The chalov, yeah.
But would the reward also be greater than?
If the person succeeds?
Yeah, the wealthy person.
Let's say yes. So there's going to be a follow-up. Why is it fair?
No,
how come he got the chance to do something with a bigger reward? And how come he got a chance to do something with a smaller reward? Okay, I'll handle that in a minute. But let's go back to the step that I skipped. What's going on here? Reuben is poor and is conquering that. And Shimon is rich and he's conquering that. And Levi is ill and he's conquering that. These are all different perfections. All of them, each one of them is a kind of parallel to God's ultimate perfection. But there are thousands of them, millions of them. So, if there are so many of them, that means each person is getting one tiny little slice. One tiny little slice. Is that what happens? It fragments like that? Now, there's a phrase that he uses in this book at least three times, maybe more. Talking about the world to come, he speaks of kibbutz hashlem. What Kaplan translates as the community of the perfected. You know what a kibbutz is? It's a failed socialist economic experiment, you know, where they spend the government's money, they bail them out of their bankruptcy, and that's a kibbutz. I'm not joking, that's the truth in this country. Kibbutz Ha'artzi movement owes the government 5 billion shekels. Okay, it's only shekels, that's true, but it's still not a small number. Because they're bankrupt. Okay, Kibbutz HaShleimim, the community, the gathering of the perfected. It always bothered me. Why are they gathered? What do you mean gather them? Convention? Each person lives his own life. Each person faces his own challenges. Each person has the success and failures. And each person gets his own share in the world to come. Why is there this concept of a gathered community of the righteous? Of the perfect? I think it works like this. Let's go back to Adam. Adam started as one, and as I've told you, we are all slices of Adam. Adam had within him the totality of mankind. With that one decision, with the tree of knowledge, had he succeeded, the show would have been over. Somehow, that one decision combined within it all of the aspects of creaturely perfection. The kind of perfection that a creature can have. He failed. The result was that he split up into billions. Billions of slices. Each slice is functioning on its own to conquer one little piece of that perfection. Okay, but it's only a piece. The existence of the perfection can't be in pieces because then each creature only gets one little piece. Sort of like having a piece of music played by 80 musicians and you get to listen to one. Ha, I'll listen to the piccolo, you know. No? I'll listen to the triangle or the timpani. No? I'll listen to the second oboe. That's not music. You've got to hear all the pieces, all the parts together to get the music. Similarly, the shleimus, the creaturely perfection that's supposed to be an analog to God's perfection, should be an integration of all these slices. So that's, I think, the idea. That's why he talks about kibbutz ha'shleimim. The community of the perfected means reintegrating all these slices into a single unity. So that the condition of Adam is somehow remade. Or maybe not made perfectly, but made on some kind of analog. I'm taking some other information into account when I say this. That's for tips. So then, indeed, each person has his slice, but the experience of the success will be in common. Because each person contributes his slice to the community, integrated community, and then everyone's achievement is available in sum to everybody else. It becomes a collective possession, rather than, it's like playing your piece of music together with all the other members of the orchestra. Yes, I'm playing this note, but when you play it, you enjoy all the music together. I speak of someone who played hundreds of times in orchestra.
And without it, it won't be the same.
Sorry, and without it, it won't be the same. Correct. Okay, yeah.
Back to when you mentioned not all suffering is punishment. So, if not all suffering is punishment, then how is it just that someone's suffering if it's not for something that they've done as a punishment?
Well, first of all, some suffering is built into the existence of a challenge for which you earn a great benefit. If, as we said at the outset, the perfection that the human being is capable of having requires it to be self-determined. Self-determined means it's going to exercise free will. Exercising free will means to be pulled in different directions. To have to make a choice. That's not fun. If you've ever had to make an excruciating decision, knowing that the stakes are large and worrying about which is the right thing and then struggling with yourself to do the right thing, that's not fun. On the other hand, if you don't do that, then you're a squirrel. And if you're a squirrel, you're disqualified from godlike perfection altogether. Squirrels aren't candidates for godlike perfection. So this is built into the very experience itself. Furthermore, as I did say also on another occasion, we asked the question, Adam was in a world where everything was 50-50, he was created as an adult, his choice was perfectly balanced. We are born into a very degraded world. The material world gained a new lower dimension, and we're 80-20 instead of 50-50. So I asked, why is it fair that we should be born into such a unbalanced condition where the evil has such a greater upper hand? And I answered then that each of us is a slice of Adam, so we all participated in his failure, and therefore we are the authors of our new condition ourselves. So those two things I think will help to answer, yeah.
Does that mean that we're all basically, each one of us is here just to perfect one slice of perfection? Once we do that, then we all get back together and then we all make up one unified...
This is a tricky question, because the we you're thinking of is flesh and blood people. Suppose we think instead of the career of a soul. Suppose we take into account that the same soul can come back a number of times. So then I don't know whether you should say that that soul has only one thing it should be perfecting.
We're saying then the soul comes down here, perfects one part of perfection, comes back again, gets another part of perfection.
It certainly could be. Furthermore,
considering
what I said before also about combinations, imagine a person spends half of his life rich and half his life poor. That does give him the opportunity for some period of time to develop the virtues of wealth, and for some period of time to develop the virtues of poverty. Right? So it could be that one person could work on a combination or variety. So I don't think it fits one-to-one like that. But how it works, I mean, he says over and over again, God does this with unimaginable wisdom and an infinity of concern and details. And, you know, we can only grasp the general principles. We're not going to grasp, in this particular case, the individual details. Sorry, you did, yeah.
As we just said, that not every suffering is a punishment. Could this concept be applied in the case of the reward, not by saying that not every success in this life could be called a reward?
In this life, for sure. For sure. In this life, much success is, as I said last time, an investment. That God invests in us to give us resources to be able to serve Him better. And certainly not reward. And indeed, the success might be mercy. The person doesn't deserve to be given any benefits, but God in His mercy allows him more time to correct himself. So there can be many explanations for success, just as there are many explanations for suffering in this world. That's a good point. I didn't usually put it that way, but I think that's a good point. Yeah.
How is one's test chosen?
How is one's test chosen? It's chosen for the particular quality of soul that the person is represents or is the soul of the person. I'll give you a little schema to understand this a little bit. Since I'm not going to name names, so maybe I can do this even though it's really part of the Kabbalah. Imagine, as it's true, a soul has 10 parts. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Mm-hmm. Now, however, each part has under it also another 10 parts. So, under part 1, there's 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, 1.5, down to 1.10. Under 6, there's 6.1, 6.2, 6.3, 6.4, 6.5. Right? Good. Each one of those parts has under it another 10 parts. So you got 6.2.1, 6.2.2, 6.2.3, 6.2.4, 6.2.5, 6.2.6, down to 6.2.10. Can you guess the next stage? I'm sure you can. And each one of those parts has under it another 10, 6.2.3.1, 6.2.3.2, 6.2, and it goes on like that infinitely. Any part you pick has another 10 under it. Why? Why is it set up like that? I'll tell you why. Because a soul has to function with 10 parts. There's no functioning without 10 parts. Now, let's suppose you have a soul. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And it gets embodied, lives a life, and in that life, it manages to perfect everything except 3 and 7. 3 and 7 are incomplete. 3 and 7 have not been successfully perfected. What to do?
Well, you have the option of bringing 3 and 7 back separately.
You don't have to bring the whole soul back. You can slice out, any surgeons here? You can slice out 3 and 7 and bring them back separately. Ah, you tell me, how can you bring back 3? 3 is only a piece of a soul. It's only one-tenth of a soul. How's it going to function? The answer is, because it's 3.1 and 3.2, 3.3, 3.4, 3.5. The whole soul structure is mirrored inside 3. And therefore, 3 can go back by itself and play the role of a soul all by itself. So that's where you have an economy of reincarnation, you see? You don't have to bring everything back. That's wasteful. Just bring back the parts that... This is how you could have so many people. How could you have so many people? Because most souls are slices. Slices further down. The more, the further down you get, the more slices there are. So the more people there could be. That's how you may hear someday that there are 600,000 Jewish souls. How can there be 600,000 Jewish souls if there are 12 million Jews? The answer is the Jews that are alive are slices of souls. Doesn't matter. No matter how far down you go, 1.8.6.2.3.7.9, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. There's always another 10. So no matter how narrow the slice is, it can function wholly, can function fully as a soul. That's what makes it possible to bring back slices. And that's probably what determines. Whichever slice you are, that'll determine the kind of perfection that your life should be dedicated to. That's the overall picture. Okay.
Don't seem like there's an infinite amount of problems.
It has to be, because underneath each slice, there's a whole infinity that's getting taken care of in one shot. Right?